tsunami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 427 of the Tsunami Escape podcast. I'm C. Kohler, and with me tonight is Crocodile.
Good evening.
Seda can't make it this week, so we're switching it up. Last week it was me and Seda. This week it's me and Croc. And I'm sure, Croc, you have a lot to say about some of these new shows since you weren't here last week.
I don't have too much more to say. I think I hadn't got a chance. I've been busy getting ready to move, so I haven't really got a chance to listen to last week's episode. But I will just say, like, I guess in terms of Lazarus, I'm still quite enjoying the show. It's a bit of a, I guess, I don't know if slow burn is the right way to go about it, but I'm still liking it. I'm still kind of curious how they're going to get this all tied to Skinner in only about, 4 to 5 episodes left. So that's still kind of like, how's that going to work? Because I don't expect this to necessarily get a second season. But otherwise, I'm still enjoying my time with it. As for Blood War, I've already seen it, and it's wonderful seeing it again. It is Bleach for better or worse in all its glory. So if you like Bleach, this is kind of peak Bleach, but of course, it being Bleach still has those Bleachisms that we will all have to contend with. Blue Exorcist still is a fine introduction to the Kyoto Saga. It seems that this traitor guy is going to make a bit of a reappearing. He's going to be a reoccurring character seen throughout this entire arc. But otherwise, I guess it's good to get back into canon because the filler was kind of a train wreck. I mean, and One Piece is just terribly. It's a interesting fight in terms of like getting a chance to see Fourth Gear for the first time. But man, I wish the adaptation and pacing were a lot better than they are.
Yeah, that's pretty typical for One Piece at this time. Well, I guess in general, even now, pacing isn't One Piece's strong suits for sure.
At least adaptation, like besides the pacing, at least adaptation now in Wano and Egghead is, to my understanding of what and what I've seen through Culture Osmosis, is pretty strong. Here, it's just everything's bad. Just like everything. So
before we begin, let's go over the news like we normally do. I've got a couple items here. The first one I'll mention, which is they did have a game review this week, which for the game Ender Magnolia, which is a sort of side-scrolling action game. I think it's the sequel to something. Not surprisingly, they gave it an 8.5.
Apparently, it's entering a long-running series. Are you familiar with the series at all?
No.
Okay. Neither am I, but I was curious if you were.
No, I just saw some people, or I think in the actual review, they referred to this as being a sequel. I will say I like the art style, the sort of hand-drawn anime characters and everything. I think it looks cool. It's not really my kind of game, though. But, hey, it's nice to see a good game review on the block.
Is it like a Metroidvania or?
I don't know. I mean, it reminded me a bit of like, well, there's just a million of these games where, yeah, I guess Metroidvania might be what it is. I don't know if it's the kind that, what do they call it? The kind where you die over and over.
Roguelite?
Yeah, I don't know if it's a roguelite, but probably Metroidvania for sure. Okay. And we had another bit of news.
Yeah, apparently there was an anime awards from... The Crunchyroll Anime Awards was, I think, this past weekend. And apparently Ninja Kamui won for Best Original Anime. And I will read off quickly the entrance. It was... Bushirogiri, a series I'm not familiar with, Girls Band Cry, a fantastic 3D anime, team of girls makes a band, it's kind of a genre in itself at this point, but that's something I actually saw and I thought was pretty fantastic, and it's a choice I would have voted for if I could have voted in this, or had an interest in voting for this. A Jellyfish Can't Swim in the Night, which is another bunch of girls form a band show, which I did see in entirety, but I was found it kind of not really compelling. It just maybe it wasn't for me. Metallic Rogue, which I think was original anime by Bones, which I hear looked really cool, but kind of the narrative fell apart. At least that's what I heard. I've not seen it. Of course, Ninja Kamui, and then Train to the End of the World, which is not a series I'm familiar with. So I would say mostly series I'm not familiar with. Ninja Kamui is much better, in my opinion, than Jellyfish Can't Swim in the Night. But Girls Band Cry would have been the winner, in my opinion. Regardless, I guess it's kind of cool that Ninja Kamui is getting some more recognition. It's, you know, I wouldn't say like a necessarily a stellar program, but definitely one of the better Toonami originals, and I think something that we mostly enjoyed as a group. And still curious if it's ever going to get a second season. I'm a little amused by how mad this has kind of made some people, but, you know, it's not really super serious. It's all like award shows, anime, it's popular contests. And this, I would say, is a lot less egregious of a misstep, quote-unquote, I'm using that big, pretty good quotes, than, like, guess Solo Leveling, which seemed to have, like, ran up the score in a lot of other categories, beating much better titles like Furin and stuff, in my opinion.
Yeah, I've not seen Solo Leveling, but I saw it win so many awards, and I'm like, I don't know, man. Even having not seen the show, I just can't believe it's that good. Like you said, everything here is a popularity contest, and so I don't know what that says. excuse me. But getting back to Ninja Kamui, yeah, it was a surprise. I saw that and I was like, wow, really? I mean, I don't have any deep love for Ninja Kamui, but I also think it was pretty decent. I thought it was, like you said, one of the better Toonami originals. And I thought it was pretty well made for the most part. I think our biggest gripes are more with the focus on mechs and less on ninjas. But it's surprising. I kind of am shocked in a way that it won out over some of these other shows, none of which I've seen. But I'm just, because I think we kind of looked at Ninja Kamui as being like a mild success for Toonami. So for it to win like best original anime is just sort of wild. Like, wow, okay. People must have been more impressed than we were, which is cool.
I think also distribution has a big, has a lot to do with it, because Ninja Kamui was on Toonami. You got the English dubs, the subtitles, both airing on TV. It was on the Adult Swim website. It was pretty well advertised, and you had a lot of eyes on it. Whereas Girls Band Cry had like a lot of distribution issues. It was only sub. It was only you had to buy like the whole series on Amazon or something. I can't remember how exactly it was distributed, but it was really weird. So I think, also, as we said, it's basically a popularity contest. Ninja Kamui was extremely well distributed compared to some of the other series. And I think that's what really played into its doing so well, that just a lot of people had actually seen it. And it's like, okay, I've seen two shows on this list. I know Ninja Kamui, so pick that. Or maybe I've only seen Ninja Kamui, I'm going to pick that. So I think that probably helped a good deal. Not to say it couldn't win on its own merits. For example, I personally still think Ninja Kamui was a more enjoyable show than Jellyfish Can Swim in the Night. But I do think distribution had a lot to deal with it.
So, yeah, congratulations to Ninja Kamui and, I guess, in effect, Adult Swim and Toonami for getting not just nominated, but to win a category. We're still stuck in a world, unfortunately, where most people, when you mention Toonami, are just sort of like, oh, yeah, I remember Toonami. And it's like, you know, we watch it every week and we have for years. So for it to be recognized is a good thing, I think, among the general anime community.
I agree.
All right. Well, I think that's all we had for the news. We're going to go through the block now as our new lineup, which debuted last week. We've got Lazarus, Bleach, Blue Exorcist, and two episodes of One Piece. I hope we continue to get two episodes of One Piece going forward for a while. I know that that's something that can change at any time, but having it now more than ever is best, since we're getting through Dressrosa much quicker. But let's go ahead and start with Lazarus. Lazarus, Episode 8, Unforgettable Fire. So this episode pretty much takes off right where we left off with the last episode. Chris has been kidnapped, and she wakes up tied to a chair on an oil platform out at sea.
By in the Antarctic, if I recall correctly.
Yeah. She's surrounded by these Russian operatives who have kidnapped her. While this is sort of introduction is going on, we do cut back to the rest of the team. And they are now being let in on what Doug and Elana had discovered, which is that Hirsch was a member of the Hog Institute, and this Hog Institute was actually the place where Hopna was developed. They confront Hirsch on this. They're like, hey, you knew a lot more than you were talking about.
I'm still kind of narratively puzzled as to why Hirsch hid this. Like, as she said, she figured they'd find out eventually, and if they were any good at their jobs, there's no way they wouldn't find out. So, like, why didn't she just tell them once, you know, at the very beginning? It's not like they could, as we kind of delve into a little bit more in this episode, it's not like they could quit Lazarus if they wanted to. So I'm just not really sure why she hid this from them. Maybe I'm missing something, forget, or not thinking of something, but it just seems like she just should have told them.
Yeah, I kind of wonder if it's like a need-to-know basis type situation. I don't know. I mean, we are talking about groups that work for agencies, government agencies, and Hirsch continues on, she talks about how Lazarus is actually a division, a special task force that's been arranged by the NSA. It's also revealed in this episode, I don't remember at what point, but it surprised me that the Lazarus group, the name of it even, didn't actually come from Hirsch. I think that it came from this larger NSA group or something. So,
yeah, I definitely feel like prior there was a feeling as to Hirsch being like the top dog on the group or whatnot, because she kind of seemed to recruit them all and everything. But it's very clear that she is not. Like, we've seen her interact with these other people beforehand, for example, a gentleman she went to the painting with the last episode. Mm-hmm. But it makes it very clear that she's like not the one in charge, whereas I feel beforehand, even if she was working with someone or for someone, kind of gave off that impression beforehand. But it makes this episode makes it feel like she's more or maybe certainly a bigger cog than the rest of the team, but certainly a cog and machine, so to speak.
Yeah. So she tells them that Chris has been captured, or she's not to be found, and that if she doesn't return within 3 days, or if she's just, I don't know exactly what the mechanism is, but they have to find her within 3 days, because if they don't, the bracelet that she's wearing will inject some kind of serum or cut off the blood in some way in her arm that will eventually kill her.
I think my understanding is that it's already implanted in her body, but it'll like activate some kind of mechanism that does do something to stop blood circulation. The exact mechanics I don't think they describe, but it's more or less the same thing. You mentioned before how they were a suicide squad. This is reiterating that they are a suicide squad, and if you don't report in like for X number of hours, we will kill you remotely.
Yeah.
Though I think stressing this, it made me think again to like, this is kind of a ragtag team of, you know, individuals kind of put together to try to find Skinner and whatnot. But for Suicide Squad, it was like very obvious that each member of Suicide Squad was extremely dangerous and could not be let out on their own devices, because they're all like criminals or ex-murderers or whatever. Whereas the Lazarus crew aren't really that. So like none of them are particularly dangerous. Well, or I guess we could talk about a little bit, for example, Chris's background. And definitely want something I want to talk about in for regards to Douglas. But overall, these are not like crazy lunatics that if you let loose in a city, they just go on a murdering spree unsupervised. So it does feel kind of weird that they have this whole Suicide Squad set up, but they don't feel like they are characters that need it.
I think it's more about making sure they do the job. I kind of took it more like not so much that they needed to protect society from them, but more that like they're being forced to do this task. And if they don't, then they'll be killed. But regardless, if they don't get her back within 3 days, she will die. The other Lazarus members are kind of like, well, we can't let that happen. And Hirsch is like, well, I'm not going to authorize that. And they're like, well, we're going to go anyway. And I kind of like that the team is starting to care about each other a bit more.
That was definitely a good moment of, because I don't think they would have done that if this was like episode one or two. Well, obviously not one, because they weren't together yet, but it was like two or three. They wouldn't definitely not have done that. So it's kind of an organic way to show how the chemistry between them has developed. I do think it's kind of funny how they're just like, Hirsch is like, don't go. And we're like, half today's we're going. And she's like, all right, I guess you're going then. And just like, okay. Yeah.
She sort of hangs back here. But as we'll see later in the episode, she actually ends up starting to help them. But she's like, this has to be off the books type situation. And we understand why now, because We cut back to the oil rig, and we've learned that that oil rig is actually a base by which the by which Russian agents, secret agents, operate out of. And in walks in the woman we saw in the previous episode briefly. Her name is Inga. She has a history with Chris, a.k.a. Alexandra, which I think Alexandra is probably her real name or maybe her Russian code name. It's not really clear. Both of which are insinuating her and this man, this other agent, tell her that that Chris is a not a defector, but a
traitor, or
what they call her?
Traitor, right?
Traitor. Yeah, thank you. I couldn't hear you. Traitor. So there's like, and then the guy who I didn't write his name down. He's particularly pissed at Chris at being a traitor. And there's a lot of really well animated but very graphic scenes in this episode of this Russian dude just beating the shit out of Chris.
I mean, there was that throw when he threw her across the room. I was like, that might be the most well animated throw I've seen in years, if not forever. Like, wow, it's just like going ham on that one scene.
It all looked really good, especially later when she kind of breaks out a little bit.
Oh yeah, when she does like the Samus Aran wall jump or wall kick just off the in wall. Yeah. Like, it's some sick, like, I don't know. I don't even say like Tekken bullshit, but it was like whatever.
I don't know. I wouldn't say that. My impression was that it all felt really believable. And
when I say bullshit, I don't mean that it's a pejorative. I was just, you know, like action hero, like jumping off the wall and doing the spinning kick and then like all the sorts of really cool stuff that like would be like impossible or near impossible to pull off in real life. That's what she was doing.
Yeah. It all looked really plausible. And like there was nothing that she did that I thought, oh, well, this is superhuman or this isn't realistic. It's like, it was all very realistic. And I remember some of the camera angles too. And that's that sequence being like, wow, they really, it's almost like they maybe, again, I think they might've used some kind of like real life reference to animate that too, because it looked so good.
I mean, having a top tier action choreographer on the show's production certainly helps.
Yeah. So, anyway, before she escapes, this guy's just sort of beating her down, and Inga is like, "Don't kill her. If anyone's going to kill her, it's going to be me." The team are about to leave to try to find Chris, or they're on their way to the airport to try to book a flight to get to where she is. And then they get sort of a phone call from Hirsch on their little wristband things. And she's like, "I've already got you set up. I've got you, a ride. There's going to be boats there. There's going to be this other stuff. I've got you hooked up. So just go to these places."
Yeah. They couldn't make it on their own because they weren't not able to secure a plane, but she got them all hooked up. So
she's helping. At first she was kind of not wanting to be involved, but now she's kind of also like everyone else wanting to help.
I also think that given her agents already halfway around the world, you might as well like succeed, right? So
so we get the commercial break. We come back. I do want to mention at the very, very beginning of this episode, there was a sort of mysterious shot of a person playing the piano. When we come back from the commercial break, we see that same scene again, but now we see another hand kind of come in, and this all plays into a sequence we'll see at the end. So they're all sort of going to the oil platform. Doug, Axel, and Leland are on this sort of like boat. Leland is on a kind of like, it's like a iceberg, like a boat disguised as an iceberg. Doug has a sort of speedboat. Axel's with him. And then Leland, what he does his drone thing, but he has this time a drone that looks like a seagull. And he uses that to sort of scout out the area, find out where the agents are.
I guess that person on, was it Twitter that was right, that birds aren't real?
At least not this one, right? And Alondra she's at some place nearby where they're just giving her free access to computer technology. Right? Elana, yeah.
Yeah. I remember the point where Hirsch was saying, "Okay, Elana, we're going to send you over here so you can work your computer magic." And it was like,
yeah.
Come on.
There were a lot of scenes in this episode of like the, like, I don't know if they're Russian or whoever they are, the people behind her.
It reminded me of, like, you know, those NASA launches where, like, everyone's in the back, kind of, like, with bated breath, like, will it work, oh my God. It reminded me a lot of those, like. Yeah.
And they're just sort of, like, amazed by her abilities. And she was pretty cool in this episode. So anyway, before we get to the actual rescue, this is the scene where Chris, in a very sort of Black Widow-like way, sort of like, that guy's like, you're just trying to get me pissed off so that you can break free. And she's doing everything she can to egg him on, and it works. And ends up getting the upper hand in the scuffle and ends up breaking herself free.
Man of bad temper talks about how he's like, man of bad temper is calling out for trying to make him mad, and then falls for it anyway.
Yeah, yeah. He's like, you're going to really listen to what she says, you know, that kind of thing. And just manipulating him. Just clearly she's been trained.
But he's also like really an easy mark too.
I do like though that like the way she was tied down, like I don't remember exactly the specifics, but like you can kind of see the moment she realizes she has an out, where it's like something isn't quite right and she's able to free herself, and but she, you know, like kind of keeps it secret for a second.
Yeah, I think
it's
like it got loose for a second one of the times when he threw her across the room or something. It got the bindings got a little loose, and that was her, you know.
What I like about that is that she didn't do that. It's like, it's just, she just took advantage of the situation, which is very realistic. Like I said,
you could say that she like egged him on kind of to loosen her bindings, like kind of an indirect way. Cause she knew he wasn't going to kill her, or is not supposed to kill her. So if she could get him to like inadvertently loosen her bindings and whatnot. So you could see if it kind of like she manipulated him to doing that potentially. So at least that's how that's how it seemed like it was being framed in my mind.
I think so, but I think the what was cool was that she kind of when she noticed it, she was a little surprised. Like there was no guarantee it was going to happen, and it worked. Sure. And it was like it was like, I don't know. Again, it's all very organic, felt very realistic. So anyway, Axel boards the thing. Leland is kind of, he's operating on a boat nearby, but he actually has I think Ilana has control of some kind of big, like a big ship that's, I guess, unmanned, that they just crash into the side of the platform, which of course causes chaos.
She'd be able to hack into some stuff. I remember she took over one of the cranes on the platform.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, actually attacking people with it.
I don't remember if she was driving the boat remotely. I don't remember who was doing that, but
Been Doug, actually, because I remember him being involved in like making sure that happened in some way. But yeah, it's just they're causing all this like diversion so that Axel can sneak in and get to Chris. And this whole sequence is very well animated. It looks really great. All this action is really good.
Yeah, straight off Mission Impossible or kind of a Bond film or whatever. Just like Axel doing his flipping and dipping. Doug, who's apparently a 23-year-old graduate MIT researcher who can also no-scope headshot people, like it's nothing. Like,
oh, yeah.
All of that in 23 years. What I call shenanigans. Like the man said he was upset at being assumed to be 40 years old, but like you need 40 years to get all that experience. So like something's not adding up.
Yeah, he's somehow gotten trained. Yeah, he's good with that rifle. Chris is been injured. And she's kind of making her way out, trying to find her way out. Everything is on fire now. And then that's when Inga confronts her.
No, I think Axel finds her first. They try to make their getaway. Axel tells her to hold on. And then while Axel stepped away, that's when Inga finds Chris, right?
Yeah, because they're alone for a moment. And this is when we kind of learn their backstory. Inga and Chris used to be agents together. It looks like they kind of, again, this is all very Black Widow, where it's like they were friends that were not really even friends, maybe. I mean, they obviously were more than friends, but they met each other in the program, the agent program, as young women, and they kind of were living together, and then they had fallen in love.
Yeah, because you see, as the sequence progresses, you're like, oh, I guess they're really, really good comrades. Oh, I guess they're really good friends. Oh, I guess they're,
Yeah, they were.
Just keep progressing. Yeah.
And the reason Inga is so mad at Alexandra is that there was an incident that occurred many years ago when there was a sort of some kind of raid or some kind of incident that occurred at an airport where they were agents operating out of that incident. And Chris was presumed to be killed in that incident, which of course made Inga very sad. But what actually happened was that Chris actually hadn't died, but she took that as an opportunity to fake her death. And with the help, I guess, of the United States government, became a defector, got a face change so she looked different, and changed her name and basically became an undercover agent for the U.S., I assume.
Yeah, I think my understanding was that there was explosion at this mission, and that, you know, it was a big fire, and then everyone lost track of Alexandra, and that's why they assumed she died. I think she was even injured but did not die, and then, as you say, kind of used this opportunity to defect.
Yeah, I mean, it was reported that she died.
Right.
But the reality was it was a fake out. She used that as opportunity to leave the program, basically. She wanted, because that was something they've also both said, is that Inga and Alexandra both had talked to each other about wanting to leave. They wanted to run away. And Inga was angry that Alexandra/Chris was able to reach their dream, and she never was.
You know, the old, why didn't you take me with you?
Yeah. So Inga is going to shoot Chris, but then that dude shows up and he sees that Inga as well was a traitor, and he shoots her.
Was it that, or was he trying to shoot Alexandra and hit Inga instead? Because I thought he was more mad at Chris.
And then I got the impression that he realized that Inga's true intention. Well, maybe not. I don't know. I got the impression that he was after her as well.
Inga hadn't betrayed anyone at that point. Like, you could see Chris, like, talking her into it, kind of. But it didn't seem to me like Inga had betrayed anyone yet. But I think, at least my understanding of the scene, is that he had come in, saw that Chris was still there, that Inga was about to shoot her but hesitating, and I think he just went in for it because he was also pissed that Chris just beat the shit out of him like a couple minutes ago. So at least that was my understanding, that he was going to finish Chris off.
And I guess I can't say with 100% certainty, but I think the fact that he shoots Inga makes me think that he thought she had turned, or that she had revealed her true intentions or something, you know what I mean?
I thought that was more that he was being a shitty shot, I guess, or that it was for maximum tragedy. Because there
could have been, I'm not sure. Regardless, Inga dies. And then Axel shows up to kill that guy, shoots him from behind, and rescues Chris, and they head out. They make a dramatic escape. Everyone survives, as far as our Lazarus team members.
We went into the water. We're kind of drowning. And then Axel found, like, I guess, I don't know, one of those jets or something on the water. And then it was like,
Because they went really deep. Yeah.
They were trying to, you know, the oil platform was on fire. Things were exploding. So you don't want to dive deep to avoid getting burned or hit or something. But, you know, Axel was basically carrying Chris, who was like badly injured. So she couldn't contribute to swimming. It was just like kind of hard to swim, carrying almost catatonic person on you. It's hard to swim,
He finds one of those underwater things that you grab onto that's like a little underwater jet thing.
Yeah,
and he like shoots out of the water. Everyone's happy to see that they had rescued Chris, and they leave. And then this episode ends with another shot of the piano players, and we realize, of course, now that it was them when they were younger together and in love. So very poignant ending.
I think someone called us out for the, I don't remember the name of the trope, but like the tragic lesbians trope or something of that sort, which I guess is kind of true. Like, I guess same-sex couples have a very poor history of making out alive in fiction. So I guess that's kind of unfortunate. There's still a lot of background on Chris. You got to learn a lot more about her. And, you know, that was very much appreciated. And of course, it was a fantastic action pieces throughout the entire episode. So, there are certainly parts to critique about this episode, but I think there's a lot of love too.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't have any takeaways myself about things I didn't like about it. Just thinking right now about it, I'm like, that was pretty good. Like, I really enjoyed it. I think people are on on our group watch are kind of like, this just series just keeps getting better with each new episode.
Oh, I didn't mean to apply also a 50-50 or like a 5 out of 10. It was I think it was a very strong episode. I'm just saying there are things that could be like, maybe I wasn't a fan of this or it could have been better, but I think overall it's definitely a strong episode. But,
yeah, I agree. I liked it, and I like that we're actually dealing with these characters and their backstories. And, you know, I had a thought too. This is, excuse me. This is more a something maybe I should save for the next week's discussion, because I don't want to discuss the preview. Let's just save that. But something I saw in the preview made me think of something about the general nature of the show that I'll just mention now, which is, you know, we kind of feel like, I think at the end of this episode, it was like 16 days remaining or whatever.
12 days.
12. Okay, 12. And
not much time left.
You know, not a lot of time left. It feels like this whole episode is not about the search for Skinner at all. Like, this is one of our teammates has been captured, may die. We're going to save her. Team building kind of thing. But I always keep thinking, it's like, what, there's this deadline. There's this deadline. But then I kind of thought about it, and I thought, you know, the truth is that the deadline is only until the very first people who ever took Hopna might start to die. And so, like, even if you reach day zero, maybe some people will die. But it's not going to be everyone, right? It's just going to be a few people, right?
It would take a while to kill off the entire 8 billion or 9 billion people on the planet. I mean, it would be more than a few people. It would definitely probably be a couple of thousands, tens of thousands each day or something. Like, I think it would be a pretty big calamity. But to get all 9 billion people, it would take a good while.
But, like, even if that's the case, like, how many people took Hopna exactly the day it was released? You know what I mean? Like, I'm trying to, like, say that, like, it's not like when day zero happens, it's the end of the world. It's like a lot of people might die, but how many is even unknown? Like, it could be 100 people. It could be 20 people. We don't know, right? And so maybe that's why the urgency doesn't feel as urgent as it should be. Like, you'd think everyone would be sweating bullets when there's 12 days remaining, but we don't get that in the series. Like, people aren't sweating bullets. It makes me think that they know that it isn't like everyone's going to die on day zero.
I would say that I think this show is definitely setting up for a case where we reach day zero before it ends the series. So I definitely think that's very true. We'll see, but I think that's increasingly likely. I do think they would still treat day zero as kind of somewhat of a calamity, because it's like unclear who exactly would die. And once people start dying, I think there's already a good amount of worldwide panic. Once people actually start dying, that's going to go up a fever pitch. So it's kind of like things can get bad fast once that starts happening. So, like, even then, you want to try to find a solution before. If things start, you know, dying, you want to try to find a solution as soon as possible anyway. If you get everything fixed, quote unquote, by day negative three, that's a pretty big difference between day negative three and day negative 100 or something.
Whereas, yeah, like, exactly.
Yeah. So there's still every incentive to, like, rush the fuck us. But, like, it's true that the series and the world will not necessarily end at day zero. Day zero is not, it's over, but there still is incentive to get things done as fast as possible, because after day zero, things are exponentially
worse. Agreed. I agree with everything you're saying, but don't you also agree that the fact that not everyone will die on day zero kind of explains why not everybody is crazy right now?
I think that might be more just the writing, because I'm just trying to think, like, obviously this is such a fantastical situation. I do think IRL, if this was something that would ever happen, everyone would understand that day zero is not, quote unquote, judgment day or Armageddon or whatever, but you would still have every incentive to rush as much as possible. So people would still be kind of freaked, I feel. I definitely feel like they did address it a little bit at the beginning, because I remember making that critique about where are the riots, and then eventually they show the riots. But I do feel like the world they show in Lazarus feels like it should be a lot more stressed than it is for a lot of people. Like, there are a lot of people who are, like, freaked the fuck out, but it feels like there should be more people given the
circumstances. I agree. I'm just trying to use this as a possible explanation for that, because you're right. It could just be poor writing, I want to give the show an opportunity to make it like make sense to me that the reason they can take 24 hours away from their job and just go save Chris is because they don't feel like if they get to 12 more days that it's over. You know what I mean? That they failed. So that's all. That's all I'm trying to say. Because I agree with you. It is a little, if there was something that I think the show needs, is that sense of urgency. It would help more if it was more dire straits than it is. But yet we have like episodes like this where it's like,
I'm just having a hard time squaring how we have like 4 to 5 episodes left, 12 days left. We're like not really that much closer to finding Skinner. There's only like lots about how the show's pace and like is not necessarily lining up with me, and it could all work out. But like, it's like, I'm just very curious to see how they land the plane, so to speak, given how much runway they seem to have left. And it could be like, oh, we get to season one. It's like, oh, watch out for season two, just announced or something. I don't know. Like, it just
could be. Yeah.
It's not, the time is not all lining up, but I'm willing to give them time to see how they land a plane and see if they do a good job of it.
And I said last week that I actually like the sort of slow burn that some of these more recent episodes have had, where you just sort of more get a feeling, like a mood from the episodes. I like that. I don't think everything needs to be rushed. I'm just trying to think of the logic of it. So I agree with you.
I think it would probably work better if instead of having 1 month, we had like 1 month in world time. We had like maybe 6 months in world time and 24 episodes. If you frame things like that, I think the pacing would work out. They'll be like, oh, okay, we'll get this done in 6 months. And then even if we miss day zero, we missed it only by a little bit or something. Like, I think that can still all work out in pretty logically, but it's just the whole 12 to 13 episodes and only a month, and then we're spending an episode here and there, like not really advancing the goal, so there's only so many days left to get to the goal. Like, that feels a little weird to me how it's structured. But again,
maybe in these next few episodes, I know we've seen the preview for the next one, again I don't want to talk about it, but like maybe even after that they're starting to kind of feel the heat of like, all right, we're coming down to the wire. You know, maybe things are desperate now. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see.
The danger there, then they might start rushing at the end, and that would also be bad too. Like going too fast or something. So, because they don't leave themselves enough room. So that's a concern of mine, but we'll see.
All right. Well, let's move on to the next show on the block, which is Bleach. Bleach, the Thousand Year Blood War, Episode 2, Foundation Stones. I just read this title just now, and I'm thinking, well, what are they talking about? What's the Foundation Stones? Was that even mentioned? I don't think, is there anything in the episode that refers to that,
I mean, maybe it might be the whole, like, no, they don't introduce that. We don't care about Bleach spoilers, right? If you do
I don't want to be spoiled for this.
Okay.
Don't spoil me on the Thousand Year Blood War.
Right, there's only one thing I can think of that might be referring to, but it's not something that I don't think is revealed till later. If it's even related to that, it might be something else. But yeah, so I'm not really sure what they're talking about, unless it's that one thing, which may not be what they're talking about. But
that would be weird for them to mention it here because it hasn't been revealed yet.
Right. Right. If it's that thing that, if it's mentioning that, so it could be, but.
Weird. Anyway, I'll start out by saying, they showed the full OP. They did not show the OP last week. That was a special sort of post-credits thing they did. But they actually showed the OP and the ED this week, and it was the full OP, probably only this week.
The ED was sped up, but that was the full OP.
Yeah, pretty good. Also, before we begin this, I will say that earlier this evening, I watched a 45-minute video on YouTube that was like a Bleach synopsis, like everything that's happened in Bleach up to this point.
Oh, you want to refresh your memory and everything?
Well, not even refresh my memory, to just learn, because even when Bleach was on the block before, I never fully understood what was going on. And with the exception of a million names that I could not possibly commit to memory, I do have a better understanding now of like, what is the Soul Society? Who are the Soul Reapers? Who are the Arrancar? Well,
whenever I get writer's block, I make new characters Taite. That's his full name.
Yeah. And it's, I have no more understanding now. And I recommend anyone who doesn't understand Bleach to go watch a video like that, because it will help you to understand. Like, I didn't for the longest time understand, like,
which video is it?
What the Soul Society is. Interesting
what video that is that you saw to help other people.
Oh, I don't know. There were a couple of them. The one I watched was called... it was called The Complete Story of Bleach Explained Up to TYBW in 40 Minutes. That was the actual title of the episode. But there's other... I saw more than one like that out there. So just check them out. All right. So this episode begins. We're in the sort of headquarters of the Quincy's. This character named Ludos Freegan is the guy who had his arm chopped off in the last episode. He's giving a report to the main bad guy. And this main bad guy is not happy with the report because Ichigo was not defeated. Bowered.
I've said his name already, right?
No, but last week we couldn't resist, and I think Seda looked it up, and it's like spelt like really it's weird.
Bowie. If I may be mispronouncing slightly, but Yue Bowie, that's his name. I think it might be like a reference from like Hebrew Yahweh and something like that. You're taking something from that, I think.
Okay.
Because Yahweh is, of course, Hebrew for God, and obviously this guy's the god of Quincy. So that's been always my assumption about the etymology of this villain's name, but.
Yeah. We cut back to Katakuri Town. Ichigo is returned from his fight. The other members are nearby, and this, including these two, like, no-name. Well, they have names, but anyway, non-important Soul Reapers. One of them gets a message on their soul phone. It's a message to all squads that says that every member of Squad 1 has been killed.
Except for the captain.
Wiped out. No, I thought the captain died too.
Lieutenant. Right? The captain is, what's the fire dude? The old fire dude? Old man Yamaguchi or something?
Oh, I didn't realize he was there.
Yeah, whatever the old guy's name.
But his lieutenant.
Yeah, his lieutenant and everyone else is dead, but the captain is alive. He's the old man again, yeah.
Gotcha.
Fire's power, yeah.
Yeah, then out of nowhere, this little girl comes flying into the room and crashing down. This is Nell. I had to look. I remember seeing her before, and now I know who she is.
I think what happened is Ichigo, after hearing the broadcast where most of almost all of Squad 1 was eliminated, he wanted to go on patrol, and then she fell from the sky from a I forget the term for those portals they use, but she hit him there. She didn't go into this room. She fell on Ichigo while he was patrolling in the city.
Okay. She says that Hueco Mundo has been taken over, and that Lady Halibel has been captured. And of course, I'm watching this for the first time last weekend, and I'm like, this is meaningless to me. I have no idea what I'm, from what I understand, I think now that Hueco Mundo is sort of like hell or the
actually,
purgatory
hell
or something.
Is a totally different place than Hueco Mundo. I don't know if there's been speculation if Kubo will ever get back into hell, because that's where one of the movies took place, and Kubo's always been teasing, like, oh, I'm going to do a full hell arc or something.
Well, what's Hueco Mundo then? Like, is it just like another
world of Arrancar? If the Hollows and Arrancars live there.
Yeah, so the Arrancars, yeah, I had to learn what that was. Those are
evolved Hollows.
Those are Hollows that are humanized.
Yeah, it's basically you can, like, let's say Digimon go from like baby to champion to ultimate to mega. I think I would say Arrancars are like ultimate level Hollows, or maybe mega level Hollows, somewhere in between there. Mm-hmm. If that makes any sense. I don't know. Are you Digimon?
Yeah, yeah, basically. Yeah, that's kind of what I learned. So anyway, she's freaking out. You need to come save us. You need to come save us. We do get a cut. We cut back briefly back to the Quincy's. The Ludus guy gets beheaded by the big bad. He's done listening to that guy. I thought the guy who lost his arm, this Ludus guy, was the guy that fought Ichigo, but apparently it was not. It was like a different guy that fought Ichigo. And he's like talking to that guy.
Yeah, I'm never a fan of villain leaders who just like, oh, you looked at me funny, minion, die. Oh, you told me good news, die. Oh, you told me bad news, die. Oh, what's your name again? Oh, it starts with J. That's weird. I don't like that. Die. It's like, that's not a good way to build, like, trust between... This is the reason why, like, bad guys lose, because, like, they're so bad that it kind of...
They just impedes rule by fear.
They impedes their own ability to, like, plan shit out. Like, that's always... Why the heroes like, oh, we won because of the power of friendship. And it's not really so much friendship. It's just more like bad guys are just bad at doing team shit and teamwork.
Yeah, it's a trope. It's a trope for sure. He's just evil.
Yeah.
He just thinks everyone's beneath him. So, yeah. We do get a brief scene where we see the funeral that's being held for Squad 1 at the Soul Society. And we see that somebody joked in the thread that, like, that lieutenant or whatever, he, like, never did anything, I guess, in the show.
Yeah, you see him, but he barely does anything. I think he jobs Ichigo in the Soul Society arc or something. I don't know. He barely does anything. He's barely a person.
So, like, him to die is, like, not as big a deal.
Right, they're trying to do, like, oh, there's stakes now. Lieutenants are dying and whatnot. But it's, like, no one cared about this motherfucker. And, like, there are... few characters later in the arc who we do care about who die. I don't think saying that is a spoiler. And I also say there are a few characters who probably should have died who didn't die. I don't think that's a spoiler either. But here right now, it's just like, this is a death, but it's like, oh, the Quincy is so tough. But like, if you kill off someone we don't care about, that doesn't really do anything.
So back in the real world, this Erankar named Peshe, is that how you say it?
Yes, I think so. Isn't that the Italian for fish or something? Or maybe Spanish? I'm not sure.
I don't know. Anyway, I can just tell he's in a Erankar from Hueco Mundo. He's there as well along, you know, he's shown up and he's like, you need to help. Please. Ichigo's like, well, I'm the protagonist. I'm a nice guy. I'm going to go help.
I mean, they know each other too. So like,
yeah, I figured as much.
Especially it was featured in the Invasion to Wake Him on the arc. He was kind of like a helper character. He was helping Ichigo, and then he was also involved in a fight with Uryu and what's the name of the guy with the baboon sword?
The red. You're asking the wrong Renji. Guy. I don't know any names.
Renji.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Renji and
I've
Uryu,
heard that name.
You teamed up with them in a fight, and so yeah, he's from that arc, so they know each other. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, the other team members from Karakurik Town are going to go, with the exception of Uru, who says he can't go because he's a Quincy. And he's going to have to bow out of this one. And Ichigo's cool with that. He's like, I understand. And then, but how are they going to get there? Well, the guy with the hat shows up, the mysterious guy.
Uruha Kisame.
Okay. You're telling me these names like I should know, and I don't.
I'm trying to be helpful. I'm
sorry. Okay, that's fine. That's fine. I get it. But just understand going forward, like, I know none of these characters' names for the most part.
Right, but I'm just saying it's better for a listener to be like,
oh, okay, yeah, that's cool.
Than, like, Hat Dude and like Purple Lady and like stuff like that.
Okay. Yeah. So what was his name?
Uruha Kisuke, or Kisuke Uruhara, I guess.
I just know that he's like a mysterious guy. Anyway, he has the ability, I guess, to teleport them or transport them to Hueco Mundo. And so that's what they do. We get a commercial break and we come back and we arrive in Hueco Mundo and we hear that all the Hollows and Erankars in the land are being slaughtered. And we cut over to a scene where we see a bunch of them are being led up against a wall and we get this new character whose name is Stern Ritter J.
Yeah, all the Stern Ritters are kind of the lead faction of the Quincy's, and they all have a letter associated with them, as well as a particular special ability, though he hasn't revealed his yet.
Okay, so Stern Ritter isn't his name, it's his position?
Correct. So basically, they're Quincy foot soldiers, which is who invaded Captain Yamamoto's dorm room the other day. Those are just foot soldiers, and then there's Stern Ritter, which are about 26 of like the elite Quincy's, and then amongst them there are also the Royal Guard, which are the elite of the elite. Basically, these are like high tier Quincy's that each have a letter associated with them, and each have a special ability associated with them as well.
So Jay here, he's very German sounding, looks
Yeah, he's like
he might.
He's probably the most Nazi looking of this Quincy.
I was going to say, like, he looks like he came right out of, like, oh, what was that vampire show?
Oh, Helsing?
Yeah, Helsing. He looks like a Helsing character. And yeah, he's a captain, and he's telling these Arrancar that that, like, yeah, you're gonna have to fight each other, and whoever's the strongest, we might pull you into our army, but you have to survive.
He's basically fucking with them because he can. Like, that's what's basically happening. He's just fucking with
them. Yeah, and one of the other Quincy's nearby is like, isn't he just gonna kill them all anyway? And it's like, yeah, probably. But there are these two Arrancar girls who do fight back. They try to get a hit on him, but they don't. But they do end up surviving where all the other ones die. So he's like, well, okay, they passed the test.
Yeah, they were a little stronger. They were in the Invasion of the Wakamono arc. They were kind of like bullying Orihime until Ukiura kind of told him to buzz off. They're not very strong. They're more like a little annoying groupies or
valuable. Well, yeah, stronger than the average Arrancar, I assume, because all those other ones died. Correct. Yeah,
relative to average Hollow and whatnot, they are strong, but relative to like anyone who matters, they are weak.
Yeah, but then we do get some more stronger characters showing up. These are the squad members of Hollybell. They're called the Tre Bestia. It's like these four girls. I think there were four of them.
Three of them. It's Mila Rose, San San, and then what's the last name's girl? Like Apache, I think is the last name for one of them. But yeah, they're Mila Rose's kind of like lieutenant. I'm not Mila Rose. They are Hollybell's like lieutenants or whatnot. So they are all under the third. What's the name of those? The top 10 Arrancar. He had a name.
I don't know. If it's not been released, then don't say it because I don't think they've said that.
No, it's from the this is all old
information. Oh, from the previous series? Oh, yeah. Well, shoot. I don't know then. Yeah, I don't know. Oh, you know what? They did mention that in that video, but I forget the name of it. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. They had a name for it. But anyway, they are strong. They put up a bit more fight against this Jay. He still doesn't seem flustered or anything. He's just sort of like, bring it.
Oh, Espada. There you go. That's what I was trying to think. The Espada.
Espada.
Yeah, so okay. Hollybell's number rank 3 Espada, and these women are her lieutenants, so yeah.
And then the last thing we kind of learn in this episode is the name of this Quincy army. They call themselves the Wandern Reich. Again, super, super Nazi-esque.
Yeah, I mean, the Quincy's are always very German-inspired, but...
Yeah, so they refer to them as a rebel army. But yeah. With the exception of like all these names and characters that I don't really know, I thought it was a pretty good episode because I was like into it. I'm curious to learn where things are going. It's just a lot to take in if you're not a like dedicated Bleach fan, because it's just the show isn't pulling any punches with like all the lore that it's just throwing at you.
Yeah, there's definitely some assumption that you're, like, at least generally... Like, obviously you can get by, like, ooh, pretty colors, fight scenes and whatnot. But there's also definitely expectation, like, you're at least basically familiar with, like, general setup of the world and kind of some of the factions, even if not all specific characters. They're also, I think, going pretty fast relative to the manga, but I think pretty much everyone agrees that that's for the best, because I'm sure you heard the arc in the manga had a lot of issues, so like this anime does a really good job of kind of improving a lot of them, elevating the arc by making lots of changes and tweaks and also speeding things up as well. Like I think they mentioned that in the anime they make it explicit that Hollybell is defeated by Yubawa, which was I guess in the manga, to my understanding, not clear. So like that kind of it kind of sucks that she got one shot off screen, but at least it was by the most powerful character in the entire series, so that makes it a little better, I suppose.
That's who he had like tied up, right?
Yes, Hollybell. That's her. Yeah.
Okay.
Did they mention that? I'm pretty sure they did. If they did,
well, they showed it.
Okay.
They showed it and they mentioned it. Yeah. He said that he had captured Hollybell.
Okay.
The leader of the.
Yeah, because she's obviously very. Her has a very unique design, is a very popular character. So like, if you see her, if you're familiar with Bleach and you see her, you know her instantly. But I was like, did he mention her name there? But yeah, I think they did. But
yeah, well, they definitely did. Yeah, I knew that. I knew that. It's in my notes. It was in my notes, and I wrote these notes before I watched that Bleach synopsis video. So
yeah,
they mentioned it. But yeah, the Wundenreich. And yeah, so we kind of know what the deal is now. These guys are, the Quincy's are back to fight and destroy the Soul Society. Pretty good episode, like I said. I'm enjoying it. I do feel like I may need to like continue to read up a little bit more on wikis and stuff. Not that I can expect to understand or remember all these names, but it helps me now to know like who's affiliated with who and in what capacity. That's the big piece that I was missing.
It'll be tested in the month. Get ready.
I would fail. I don't know. We'll see. Hopefully I get better at it. I have a hard enough time remembering even the main characters. Like I had to look in my notes to remember what Uru's name is. Like, and then like, I understand, I know the one guy's name is Chad, but that's not even his name. That's just a nickname.
His name is like Sato Yoshira or something like that. He's like half Mexican, half Japanese. So he has a Japanese name, but everyone calls him Chad.
All right. It's a pretty good episode. Let's move on to Blue Exorcist. Blue Exorcist, the Kyoto Saga, episode 27, Strange Bedfellows. And just like with Bleach, since it's a first time airing, we get to see the full uncut OP of this new season.
I do think it's probably the worst OP so far for the series, but that maybe others disagree. I don't know.
I don't know. I thought it was, my impression was that it was like on the same level as the previous ones. The thing is, I don't remember. Were there two OPs in the first season?
Yes.
Okay. I need to go back and watch the second one because I only remember the first one. All right. Anyway, the schoolmates of True Cross Academy arrive in Kyoto and they are introduced to this character named Kin. He's the local representative for the exorcists here in town. He's also related to that pink-haired kid named Renzo. This guy's a bit of a klutz, bit of a goof, and Renzo's really embarrassed by him. They go back to, he takes them to this temple where Bon is reunited with his mom, Toriko. She at first looks like she's going to be the very demure, sweet mother, and then just walks up to him and starts beating on him.
Literally starts pulling the hair out of her son's head. It's kind of funny. Yeah. Like, I guess I didn't realize that. I thought everyone just had like generic anime colors for their hair and whatnot, but apparently everyone's just been dyeing their hair. So I guess that was kind of.
Some characters do that, not often in anime, but it does happen.
Yeah, usually just hand be like, oh yeah, she just came out of the womb with pink hair or whatever. Like, but no, here this is.
That's true. There's actually two characters in this episode who get ridiculed for dyeing their hair, the other one being Renzo. Yeah. Whose hair is not pink.
I assume, again, it was just anime hair color, so I just hand-waved it.
Right. No, I guess they color it, So we kind of get introduced to what's going on here. A bunch of the exorcists here are sick, I guess because of the miasma. And the True Cross Academy students are all put to work doing various things. Some are healing. Others are just doing odd jobs. Rin, they don't know what to do with Rin. I will say I like that Rin walks around now just in his fully transformed form now. Like, he doesn't have to hide it anymore.
He doesn't have the flames on, but besides that, he's no fucks given mode.
Yeah, he's got the ears and the tail and the teeth and everything. And that's like how it should be, I think. But anyway, Kin is kind of like, I don't know what to do with you. Just take out the trash or something. While he's doing that, Rin does bump into Bon / Ryuji's dad, who is this drunk monk who was in the opening.
And they kind of have Bond a little bit. He definitely, Rin definitely sees some of his own father in Bon's father. So that's kind of neat, not coincidence, but kind of like, I guess bonding is maybe the best way to describe it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And we do cut back and we see some of the wounded here are starting to fight. They get some infighting amongst them. There's this one adult male monk who's fighting against these three girls who have these very distinctive eye tattoos on their face. One of them is named Mamushi.
He's like, yeah, one very normal looking human monk, and then three very anime looking female monks. Is, you know, the dichotomy is a little funny to me.
Yeah, he's like a nobody, obviously, and they're like, we're badass. They start using some exorcist abilities on each other. She fires out a snake, a very Orochimaru style.
Oh, yeah, I was about to mention that, but yeah, you beat me to it. Yeah.
And he's got some other ability or whatever. And then the other characters walk in to stop him.
Yeah, apparently Bond can also use jutsus, but he's just never used it throughout any of the first season. Like, he just comes in just a jutsu and stops them. I was like, oh, he can use magic? That was news to me.
All he did in the first season was just read scripture. Huh. That's interesting. Yeah, you mentioned that. I didn't even think about that. We get the commercial, and then we come back, and it's nighttime. Bond wants to go see his dad, but what's the name of the Shura? Is that her name?
You mean Boobzilla?
Yeah, Boobzilla Shura. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, that's her name.
She's like, well, I can't let you leave right now because he lives way out in the mountains and it's dark and it's dangerous. You can't go out there. One of the other kids, though, the glasses kid, he does go see his parents. We see later in a brief scene that he's just visiting their graves. Some of the characters, though, run into Rin. And Rin's like, hey, come eat dinner with me. And nobody wants to eat with them because they're all like kind of afraid of him.
It was like Renzo, glasses, and was Bond with them, or did he already leave? I can't remember.
I think Bond was there, I think.
He was there and then peaced out. And then Izzy.
Yeah.
Izzy's a glasses kid. I say Izzy because it's the same voice actress who voiced Izzy from Digimon as this kid whose name I can't remember. So I'm just calling him Izzy. So I think it was, so all three of them were there, right? And then Bond and Izzy peaced out, and Renz was like, oh, fuck, I'm the last man standing, I can't escape, kind of thing.
It's a kind of a nice scene there. Just sort of like, it's like, I gotta get out of here. You hear like their inner monologues, I gotta get the hell out of here. And they do, with the exception of Renzo. And Renzo's like, I'll eat with you, I guess. And then they ends up eating like far away from him. And like, at this point, it starts to become noticeable that Rin is like drunk.
Yeah, he took like one, he took what he said it was juice, took one swig and it was like plastered. And I was like, oh, are we doing the thing like Persona 4 where Yukiko gets drunk off apple juice thing, but just really fast? Is that what we're doing now? But apparently we'll reveal later that I guess Shura's beer and then their juice somehow got swapped. I'm not sure how that happened. But apparently Rin and also Bond too are just drinking alcohol and just like the lightest of lightweights. I mean, I guess they're like 16 or whatever. So
but yeah, I'm assuming it's just they don't normally. And yeah.
Even still,
that was, kind of I like that they answered that with the whole like fun twist. It's like, oh, we got our drinks mixed up or whatever.
I think that's actually better than the whole like, oh, I'm just getting drunk of apple juice that I, you know, a lot.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So. I never got that impression. What I took it was is like, well, they're just letting them drink. And I was like, is that a thing?
Because I've just seen so many games anime do the stupid drunk of apple juice nonsense. So that's why I thought it was happening. So that it wasn't happening was actually to the shows. It's not a big deal either way, but I appreciated that, I suppose.
So Renzo, after a few minutes, is like thinking to himself, he's like, what am I just need to get over this. Just the guy's not being, you know, Ren's not being a jerk or anything. I just need to get over it. And he starts kind of getting cool with Ren.
I did that he was like, it's so much energy avoiding you that I'm exhausting myself. I'm just going to just be normal. Like, because as you said, like, obviously he's a son of Satan. That was a big shock for everyone. And unlike the filler where everyone just got over it, like, there's still ramifications dealing with that in canon. But Renzo's just like, this is too much effort. You're not, like, burninating us. You're acting like a normal person, so I'm going to act like a normal person to you, too.
Yeah. I think that's slowly going to happen to all the other characters. Right now, everyone else still is reserved, with the exception of Uzumo. Like, last episode, she was really cool, but like, Shammy is still distant. Bond obviously hates him. Glasses guy is still distant. So,
well, actually, is it? I think it's more Rin avoiding Shammy than the other way around, I feel.
I don't know. Even when he's not around, like, there was a shot in this episode where we see like Shammy washing dishes and Rin walks by, and then she sort of gives this look like she's like apprehensive. I think Uzumo notices it.
I could definitely be misreading it, but it felt more like Rin was one of... It felt like Rin was the one afraid to approach her the other way around. That's the vibe I've been getting. I could be wrong, but that's what it feels like to me.
I'm gonna watch in the next episode. I'm gonna pay closer attention because you could be right.
I mean, obviously, Rin has.
I thought though when they got on the plane, I thought that Rin was like, "Hey, Shammy," and then she didn't answer him.
Was that? I may have to really watch that episode. It definitely, like, I know he has feelings for her, so I think he's extra like self-conscious about what had happened and like maybe extra afraid of hurting her and whatnot. So I think he's obviously being a little awkward around her than he would versus Eyebrows or any of the other women or guys or whatever.
So I won't go into details here, but it's kind of revealed that Ryuji's dad, this monk, basically was kind of outed from this whole thing, or he like left deliberately.
I think it was like people were losing faith in his leadership because the Blue Knight happened under him, and he was also having a drinking problem. So like people were leaving, and like I think he stepped aside from leadership to like stem the exodus.
Well, it was when it was announced that they were going to become a part of the Trucost, like whatever that.
Oh yeah, there was a merger, and he stepped down as CEO basically.
Yeah, basically. And then there was also some like rumor that like, or truth or something, that he had given away one of the Miyota sect's most sacred relics. And so that was another thing people were upset about. Anyway, it's another situation where like this guy's obviously being misjudged, and maybe he is a bit of an alcoholic, but otherwise it's like he's a good guy that people are looking down on.
He was kind of drinking because he felt like down on himself too, so maybe being a little like self-destructive, and maybe kind of a loop of like being self-destructive, people looking worse on him or something. I'm sure we'll learn more about him, obviously, but
yeah. And then the last 5 minutes or so of the episode is basically like Ryuji's Bond's backstory. Like we see him when he was a kid, and you know, he's really wants to be with his dad and is really excited and all this stuff. And then we also see later on that he becomes much more gruff and stuff, and upset that his dad isn't, everyone hates his dad and stuff like that. And then he decides when we see the moment where he goes to tell him that he's going to go to Trucost Academy because he wants to be an exorcist, a true exorcist. So we kind of get this whole backstory with Bond.
Yeah. He takes this stuff super seriously. Like he was memorizing scriptures when he was like five and stuff. And like, I think it just grinds his gears, especially that his dad seems to be not taking this seriously.
The end of the episode basically ends on a scene that I actually found quite confusing, but basically Yukio and some other exorcists are riding in a car. It's like a snake that's like, there's something up ahead. And then they pull over and they see this car full of dead people.
I think it's just like exercise stuff. And then like, I guess the traitor is up on some random tower monologuing maniacally and like, haha, Yukio, soon you'll be on my side. As he twiddles his fingers.
Yeah, we can't really see who it was. It looked like he had glasses maybe, but...
No, it was the dude from the previous episode who like turned traitor. Remember that dude?
Oh, it was him? Oh, okay. Yeah. I couldn't see his face. Okay. It was the guy that was the demon who had been possessed by the demon.
Right.
Anyway, so he was talking on the phone to someone. So
all part of my master plan, knee, or something like that.
Yeah. So I think that's it for Blue Exorcist. I continue to enjoy this.
It was a fine
There's
episode.
A lot of lore in this episode. Yeah. It's so interesting that I'll only talk about this briefly, but just like the first season, you know, we were full on in filler at this point, right? And it's like we're learning so much more interesting and detailed information about characters and motivations and stuff in this canon stuff, like right out of the gate, like Bond's backstory. It's like, I get that they had to, like, I guess, choose to, I don't even understand why they did what they did.
I don't know what was the circumstances for the first anime season's production. I don't know why they started so early, because they started, like, there was not enough manga to adapt a full season when they started. Like, so I don't know why they started so early. I mean, I guess the manga must have been a huge overnight sensation or something, but could have waited. I mean, I don't know. I guess the same thing happened to Fullmetal Alchemist. They started pretty early, and so much so that they had to do a whole filler back half of the series, but
That's a good point. You know what I just realized is that this is what we've always wanted from like Soul Eater.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
This is what they should have done with Soul Eater by now. They should have come back and stopped at the episode they broke it and just, yeah, anyway. All right, well, let's move on to One Piece. One Piece episode 727, A Massive Counterattack, Doflamingo's Awakening. The fight continues, and Doflamingo is kind of like realizing that Luffy has to use a huge amount of haki to continue to use fourth gear. So he's kind of waiting him out. He's kind of goading him to continue to use up his strength. And out of nowhere, we see Jesus Burgess is here. I kind of completely forgot he was here.
He hasn't done anything since the end of the Colosseum fight, so that's good, like 40 episodes ago, maybe more.
Yeah. It's like they set up that he was here, but then he's just been hiding for a long time. But he is here, and he's doing his goofy laugh and got his eyes on Luffy, and we see Koala is nearby secretly watching him. I like Koala. What's not to like about Koala?
Does she get to do more in future arcs? She hasn't really done much arc. Does she get to do more later?
I don't. Not really. She's around. She doesn't get to be a badass, if that's what you're asking.
Oh,
not that I remember.
Not necessarily a badass, though. That would've been cool. But just I don't know something. She hasn't really.
She's. You know, I mean, we know. I mean, it's obvious.
Shows up.
Yeah, but she's really a member of the. She's a member of the.
Revolutionary Army, right?
Revolutionary Army. So she's around quite a bit, actually. So, but it's always in the same kind of capacity that we're seeing here, where she's
standing around a corner giving a report.
Yeah, just, you know, or relaying information or doing that kind of thing. Yeah. Everyone's running. Frankie and the Tontadas are at the Smile Factory, and Frankie's like, we gotta go. The birdcage is here. And the birdcage hits the Smile Factory, but then Frankie kind of notices, like, oh, it's not cutting through. And that's because the Smile Factory was made out of sea prism stone. And he's like, huh, well, that's interesting.
I assume that's going to become a big plot point maybe not next episode, obviously, but episode after that or something. I don't know. Like, feels like that we should be doing some of that fact, or we're going to. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. And this is kind of leads us into the big moment. The big, I think, canonically big issue here is that Doflamingo is like, you don't really quite understand what I can do with my power. It's a power that you really haven't experienced. See, you see, when some people are really good at their devil fruits, they can become awakened. And then when he does this, he starts to turn all of the town, the buildings, into strings. And even Luffy is like, this isn't like a paramecia. What is going on? And this is apparently a whole other level called Devil Fruit Awakening. And this is what Doflamingo is doing. We've heard Awakening before. It was mentioned in Impel Down.
Yeah, I was about to mention that. This is not the first time you've come across Awakening. I will say, though, that this quote-unquote Awakening is so lame. Like, it's just... I mean, when you think Awakening, you think like, you know, domain expansion or a Bankai or like Super Saiyan level 3 or something like really cool, like a next level step of evolution. But it's, and honestly, I'm sure the adaptation is not helping things with like slideshow nonsense going on. That's not helping. But it's just Doflamingo's powers are like, oh, I turn buildings into strings and then I shoot things at you like I did before, but now they're bigger. It's just like, that's so lame. And I know... I already know about gear. I don't think saying gear 5 is much a spoiler because, like,
now we've said it. Yet. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, gear 5, that's like an impressive awakening compared to, like, the previous gears. But Dofi's shit is just, like, nothing about this is cool or impressive. It's just lame.
So, this is the kind of the most basic form of awakening where it's basically, it's like, normally, Doflamingo can only produce some strings from his body or turn himself into string, things, these kinds of things. But this is where he's able to manipulate the environment and turn it into strings. And that's where the awakening part is. It's like he's just mastered his devil fruit so well that he can extend his power even to things that aren't part of him. And with the impel down, those were, I forget the name of the devil fruit type, but the kind where it's an animal. Zone. Yeah. So Zoan Awakenings, again, just another more powerful version of the Zoan ability to become an animal. This is the more powerful version of being able to control strings, where he can actually convert things into strings.
I feel like if your power is to convert things of the environment to strings, do something cool with it. Like, I don't know, like convert Luffy's body into string or something. I don't like, just do something cooler than this. It's not like, yeah. Even Jolene from Star Ocean was using, had more impressive string powers, I feel, at least in coolness factor, than what Doffy's doing here. Like, it's just not impressive. Like, the battery of powers he already had, like, making clones, basically air walking, puppeteering entire populace. Those are, I think, more powerful, interesting applications than his awakening. So it's just like, yeah, it's just lame. Not impressed by the utility. Again, the production and adaptation is probably not helping matters either, but not impressed with any of those aspects. It's just like, this is weak. Weak.
So we see all the citizens are running, but we also see some other citizens that are just giving up. The old lady falls and she's like, leave me. Little girl's crying. We see a man who only has one leg and he has a crutch and he's like giving up. And there are a bunch of people at a hospital and they're crying for others to help and nobody's helping them. And they're just all giving in. And so King Riku decides that it's finally time for him to do fucking something. And so he picks up a transponder snail and gives a big speech where he's just like, you remember me, I'm your king. Everyone run. Stay alive for as long as you can because Luffy is going to save us. And then that's when we get the power of township, where the whole town decides, okay, I guess we should stay alive and help each other, and at least until Luffy saves us.
Yeah, I mean, that was, I guess, yeah, it was good to see Riku like do something, but I don't know, like, this was for inspirational, motivational speech. This is kind of weak. Like, I'm thinking to myself, I was watching ReZero season 3 recently, and Subaru Natsuki, I don't know if you're familiar with that series. But he had to give a whole motivational speech, and that speech was actually kind of impressive. And I'm just thinking of it compared to like this weak sauce, sauceless Riku speech. I'm just like,
I felt the same way. I thought it was weak. I also feel like he was talking so slow, and I'm like, dude, people are dying. Pick up the freaking pace, dude.
Yeah, I mean, that's faster. That's some Toei magic. Some like padding. Well, everything happened here was, I'm sure, padding. That was definitely like also more some more toy magic.
Well, even that though, he's just like, he's like, I don't know. He just talks for too long.
I don't really understand why Doflamingo didn't just kill Riku. Like Riku hasn't really contributed much to this arc whatsoever in the present. Like there's no reason for him to be alive, I feel.
I thought it was, more about like, just, I don't know. Cause he's evil and he wants to just see him suffer. I don't know. Yeah, it's stupid of him to do it. But then again, Doflamingo's, that's his overconfidence is his weakness, you know?
It's weird because Doflamingo's probably like the most planned shit out villain the Sprockets has come across. Yeah, like basically Doflamingo was like, okay, I see this Luffy kid as the main character of the series. Everyone get some information on him. Like he figured that out like 3 years ago, but somehow he couldn't be bothered to like kill Riku. That seems like
again, I don't think it's not that he wasn't smart enough to. It's like he lets his own hubris defeat him. That's the he's too proud to assume he thinks he can keep Riku alive and torture him because he's Doflamingo.
Okay, well, I guess I think if you're the type of character who's John Savory enough to like plan ahead for the main character of the series, you should be John Savory enough to not be so proud, so egotistical that it backfires. Whatever.
He has to have flaws, and this is his flaw. His flaw is that he does not think he can lose. All right, so that's the end of that episode. Let's move on to the next one, which is episode 728, Luffy, an all-out Leo Bazooka. And before you ask, I do not know why it is called Leo Bazooka. I have no idea. We get more town running, people running and screaming. Doflamingo is turning the town into string. And
wasn't there like even like a recap, extra long recap this episode? Or
oh, yeah. Well, it was funny. It was like 3 minutes of recap. And I swear 2 minutes of that recap was the exact same recap we got in the last episode. And it was only the last 30 seconds that was new, which was the Riku speech. So it was kind of really super recappy. Anyway, Doflamingo's doing things with strings. He's hitting him with strings. He's wrapping him in strings. He's doing all this stuff. But Luffy decides he's going to do like a headbutt. So he does like a Gear 4 hockey headbutt. And yeah, hits him. And then he's got like, you can, at this point, Luffy's just like, he's running out of time. He's like, I don't have much more time. I can do this. And then he does this move he calls Gum Gum Leo Bazooka, which is kind of like a Hadouken from Street Fighter.
Like, I admit, like, I turned around for a moment, I missed it, but he just does like the whole open palm, like kind of claw motion. It's
like a strike.
Yeah, palm strike. Yeah,
I mean, he doesn't literally throw a fireball or anything. He just hits him.
Right, but.
Yeah. Just hits him in the stomach and it just sends Doflamingo all the way into the side of the Flower Hill. And like a big crater is there. And he's just sitting there. And everyone just immediately is like, oh my God, Luffy has won. He defeated Doflamingo. It's over. We're saved. And it takes them like a good 2 or 3 minutes before they're like, well, wait a minute. The birdcage is still there.
I mean, well, like, I think a lot of it is also there's like during these two episodes, I think Luffy is kind of making the comments stuff. I got to do this quick. I got to finish them off fast. Doflamingo was like, and I think Luffy's working borrowed time. But an adaptation just has like Luffy like sitting around either like jetting through the air or bouncing around like aimlessly for like minutes at a time, like just wasting time. So like that's obviously like totally adding filler, but it's very like intention with the actual narrative. Like people should not be acting this way given what they're saying, but because Toei has to fill time, they're just, you know, wasting time. It's really bad here. Oh, and there's this moment where, like, everyone thinks they won, and then some random guy's like, but Luffy's a pirate. Can we trust him? And then he spent, like, 5 minutes.
Oh, I hated this. I'm just like, everyone's just like, Luffy, you defeated him. Wait a minute. He's a pirate. I hate him. It's like, what?
It's really reminds stupid. Me of that meme with Mr. Krabs. It's like, I remembered. I hate things. It's just like, dude, what are you talking about? I mean, I was just getting toy filler, obviously, but it's just, like, really poorly placed here.
Yeah. And in this moment, Luffy does finally burn out. He reverts back to his normal form. He can't keep Gear 4 going anymore. Falls to the ground. And this is when we see Jesus Burgess again. And he's saying he wants to take the gum gum fruit. This is his opportunity. Luffy's knocked out. This is his chance. He's going to take the gum gum fruit from Luffy.
I mean, doesn't he have the only way to do that would be kill Luffy, though, right? And then hope the fruit generates nearby, basically?
I would assume, yeah. But before even that happens, we hear some rumblings, and we look up, and Doflamingo's got a big smile on his face. He's not done. He's not defeated yet, to no one's surprise. I mean, except for the townspeople who are stupid. So Doflamingo is not yet defeated. The fight is still going on, but now Luffy is out for the count for the moment.
He's going to get back up again. Knocked out.
I'm sure he will. Hopefully he'll get back up. We'll see. You think Luffy will win? I mean, I think there's a good chance.
Yeah, I think Luffy will stay down and Doflamingo will win and the series is going to be over. And it's going to be now, instead of being One Piece, it's going to be like a wacky Adventures of Doflamingo. There we go. It's a new show.
The Doflamingo Pirate Hour. Yeah. So that's it for One Piece. Again, like I said earlier, this arc is so much more digestible when we get two episodes a week.
I definitely would like to see this arc again, but like either done via the live action where they speed things up and change things to in mostly positive ways, or they do a reanimation like the One Piece or something. Like this arc definitely needs another go. Like both not only for pacing issues, but there's also, like, I think you could just make some actual changes to it, though obviously that need to have Oda's approval. But, like, I feel like this arc, they need to redo.
I didn't watch the Fishman Island redo, so I don't know how much better that was, but that's basically what they did there.
Yeah, but I think they also probably need to make a few tweaks too, like maybe obviously not to conflict with future plot points, but like some maybe narrative tweaks would be appreciated as well. But again, you need to get Oda on board for that. But yeah, I don't know. This needs a second draft, and it also needs to be adapted.
I joked that someone should just take all of the recaps from all the episodes and just turn that into a TV series. I bet if you edited that, like, I wonder, like, especially if you removed all the duplicates parts, like, I mean, how many, like, you could take Dressrosa and turn it into, like, 12 episodes if it was just, like, the recap footage with the voiceover.
Even narrative or workout.
Yeah, I think that would make a pretty interesting little edit. All right, well, before we close out the episode, do we want to do any flavor alerts?
Flavor alert.
Potential award nominations.
We put first on the best character yet. I can't recall if we did.
Who?
Chris. Lazarus.
No, we have not.
I think she's fleshed out enough of the character now, both in terms of her accomplishments and her background, that I think it's probably worth it.
Okay. By the way, they did reveal in this episode that her last name is Blair. But again, Chris Blair isn't even her real name anyway, but I'm going to put that down.
I mean, yeah, that's the name she goes by now. That's the name we should put on the what's it called?
Yeah. I put it in there in the spreadsheet. I will tell you this. I'm not ready to yet, but I have a feeling we're going to get some great names in Bleach. Bleach is notorious for names.
Oh yeah. The Wonder Reich all have kind of ridiculous names. The Sternwriters all have ridiculous names. So yeah,
absolutely. We'll get once those start to come out, we can start. I'm looking forward to that. I don't know any of them yet. I'm just assuming it's Bleach. They have stupid names.
I don't know if, like, there are a bunch of action set pieces that are pretty spectacular. I don't know if that all clusters into a moment, or would you just be like the rescue, the oil rig rescue, or would that be like a moment?
I don't know. I mean, it's a tough thing because, like you're saying, there's been a lot of really good sequences in Lazarus that are action sequences. This didn't feel particularly better than any other to me. It was really good, but it wasn't like I still think back to that episode with the nightclub, and that sequence
was really, 4. Really good. That was pretty strong as well.
Don't know. I don't feel like this like stood out any better than the other ones to me.
I'm still kind of shook by Douglas just no scoping, headshotting like 12 people in a row. Like, it's like, what the hell?
Maybe they have AI in their guns now. They might. Smart bullets or something. Or he's just really good.
I mean, that's crazy good, but. I mean, again, I wouldn't just nominate that. It would be the whole like rescue. But if it's nominatable, it may not be. But
yeah.
I don't really think of much else.
Yeah, I'm kind of looking at the categories here. We did nominate last week the Luffy versus Doflamingo fight. Just we went ahead and just added it. Because it's not even over yet.
That'll be the entire fight, though, right? So
yeah, it's everything.
Yeah, so that's under best moment or something, right?
Best fight.
Fight. Okay. I hope we can get something better, just because that fight is so undermined by the adaptation and pacing issues that I don't like. If
it doesn't have to win, we're just nominating it.
Sure. Right. I'm just saying. Like, I hope we get better. I hope we can have fights on there that we can put on that are. Better.
Well, yeah, by the end of the year, maybe. I mean, This is the end of Dressrosa.
Bleach. Wait, Bleach is going to be on the block. That shouldn't be a problem then. Okay, we're good.
Yeah. I was just talking about Dressrosa. Like, this is it. I mean, there's no one else to fight except Doflamingo at this point.
Except then Baby Five turns rejoins the group and reveals her ultimate form, Baby 55, and then makes her moves.
Baby Five's new form is housewife.
What an odd she character.
Fully wants to be. I don't know. There was no worst moment this week, was there? I mean, nothing really offended me.
No, not particularly.
No.
I mean, even the guy, I hate pirates. Is that was stupid, but I don't know if that's a worst moment. It's just stupid.
It's pretty stupid, though. It's like, it's so common in the One Piece, townspeople to do that. Like, to just suddenly on a dime be like, I hate the good guys.
And the brains just start leaking out of the ears all of a sudden. Just like, what's going on, people?
Maybe he was being manipulated by Doflamingo in that moment. I don't know. It's illogical. All right, okay. I don't have anything.
Yeah, I think the only thing that's probably worth saying that I think we forgot to mention in the news is that the miniseries for Liquor's Recoil did wrap up the other day. So it was just a bunch of six cute episodes of, cute girls doing cute things and some of their friends getting on into action. Nothing insane, but it was nice to see the cast again. So
in the final episode, they do kind of reveal that, like, Liquor's Recoil is, like, a known thing, even if it's just, like, in the form of a movie. Did you see that?
Yeah, that was, like, so... I think no, because wasn't the excuse they used that they were filming like how that whole terrorist thing went down? I was like, oh,
that's right, okay. But it was even called like Liquor's Recoil, though. It even had the name, right?
So yeah, I think just people have just pieced together little things like, oh, I heard they're called Liquor's Recoil. Okay. Oh, it was a film they're shooting, and I think people piece things together or something, and then. I don't know if anyone actually made a production about it. I don't know if there's an actual movie that was made.
It's like a movie poster she was holding up, right?
Yeah, but I don't know if that was like a poster for like a real movie or a poster for kind of like a, like a concept of a movie or something. I'm not entirely sure. But yeah, I did see that. But
yeah. I think it's interesting. That's the only, you're right. Everything that happened in all six episodes were like nothing. And then they were never meant to be anything. They were just sort fun slice of life. But that was the only thing out of all six of them where I felt like that actually kind of has like a story impact in a small way where it's like, yeah, people would know what happened in that final episode. So,
right.
You know, it's kind of interesting, but yeah.
I will say it was a little, I think they closed out the ending theme and then it was obviously pretty, but also a little sad remembering that the person was saying that is both or was both much younger than me, but also is now dead. So I was like, oh, right. Fuck.
She passed away.
But, still a wonderful song. So it's always nice to leave something behind to the world for your art and
whatnot. Yeah. I saw a number of comments from people that were saying that about the ending sequence. And they were like, oh, yeah, get to hear that song one more time. It's sad, but it's also really nice. Yeah, if you want to check it out, all six episodes are on YouTube. So anyone who hasn't seen it, just go to YouTube. You can just watch them.
I think they're on Aniplex channel, right? With full English subs.
Yeah, it's like the English Aniplex channel. And then the final episode, they did have like a special end credits too, where it was like scenes from all six episodes, like a movie credits type thing. I still think that this was all just done just as a sort of like keep Liquor's Recoil in people's minds because they're working on a new one. So
they seem to be taking their time with a second season. I mean, obviously, I don't want to rush people. I don't want to like... burden the animators, I don't know, crunch them and whatnot, but it does also seem like they're taking a bit of time.
I will tell you though, it really gives me a lot of like positive hope about it because about the quality of the second season, because this looked as good, if not better, than the season we saw.
I mean, yeah, these little episodes. There weren't really any action sequences here, but like for the day to day, like character animations and stuff like that, yeah, it seemed pretty much on par.
Everything, it looked really good. They were funny and. Yeah, it's just the quality of the animation is top notch. So if that's what the next season is going to look like, then hey, we're great. Okay, well, I think that's it. We'll go ahead and wrap it up here. That's it for episode 427. Thanks for being here, Crocodile.
My pleasure.
And we will return next week for episode 428. Again, we'll have the same four shows to go over. So until then, later. Later.